listening to Muslimish Freethinkers, a podcast dedicated to fostering conversations on matters of faith and disbelief.
Your talk this time. I mean, I always love your talk, but this specific talk was, I loved it personally. And there's just one thing that I wanted to ask you about, which when you're saying that religion is natural and science is not, which I thought, I disagree with that. That's like, only, I loved everything else except that one part. Mm-hmm. Because to me, I feel science is natural and religion is not. And at least once you understand it, I mean, it takes a while to understand, but once you get an understanding of what science is, I think evolution, you look at, you know, chimpanzees and how similar they are to humans, that's natural. It's just because, I mean, I think it's just because we've been conditioned to think that this is the natural way of things. That's why a story about a flying donkey seems to be, you know, the natural state, but it's not. It really is not. So why do you think that religion is the natural state and not science?
I feel like Zerar wants to answer this.
I thought I just feel it.
Yeah. I mean, this is, it's not my opinion. It is something that when I heard the author of this book speak before, and then I purchased his book, and it made a lot of sense to me. It's just it took me 6 months to understand the theory of evolution. I was an engineer, so I've never studied biology beyond grade 9. And I skipped evolution due to religious reasons. And I brought a paper from the sheikh to the teacher at that time. So I never really understood evolution. And then if we are ever questioned about it, in the Islamic environment, it's always like dismissive, very dismissive. Like, oh, this theory, yeah, it's old theory, nobody believes in it. Man came from monkey and it has been disproven. So when I was exposed to it, I was a member of an Islamic organization, and then we received a question about Lucy. It was at the time where the research about Lucy has been finalized and published, 2008. So, and I referred the question to the committee, and the committee had no idea what they're talking about. And I thought that would be embarrassing to publish their answer. So I thought, let me try to, redo the answer. And then it took me a while to understand what's going on. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to write an article about Islam and evolution. And what was supposed to be like a couple days effort took me 6 months of daily studying and reading, and then going to the University of Michigan nearby if I had like serious questions with professors, and it deconstructed a lot of the things I knew. I had depression. I had a friend come from Ottawa to support me because it was I was struggling a lot trying to understand something that is deconstructing a lot of the things that I used to believe in before. But this process was not simple to just explain to my like young daughter or old mother, or you know, it's just not simple. So I understand you. Once you understand it, everything makes sense. It's like a key, and then everything like falls into place, and there's no the natural world, the biological world, just makes sense. The model just works out beautifully. But to get to that point, you know, like, you understand if I tell you there's 100 people outside, there's 1,000 people, there's 1,000, things. But once I tell you there's 10 to the 32 planets in front of you, just the number doesn't make sense anymore. Like, our mind hasn't evolved. I'm just reflecting on my reading from the book, but you can read it for more information. So science is just, it goes beyond our... the knowledge that we need for our daily life. So it takes a little bit of effort. And it's a beautiful thing as humans that we can really comprehend. And then it can be simplified. I mean, Richard Dawkins wrote The Magic of Reality, right? As an effort to introduce science at a 15 years old level with illustrations, you know. But it takes an effort. While it's very simple to say that, there was, you know, a great power that's unseen, and it created us, you know, for it's just a story that we have naturally evolved to. And this has, I mean, it's a scientific talk. I feel I'm not qualified to answer the question. It's more like an evolutionary biologist should answer the question. Why did we evolve to, why religion evolved with us? And we eventually, we're probably going to evolve out of it with scientific education effort, you know, that continues on.
And there is a historic thing also to it. Sorry, it's your topic, but it's if you look at the caves where cavemen used to live thousands of years ago, you'd see some of the ancient drawings that they actually had a god. They were worshiping sun, or they were worshiping whatever any force of nature way before they started having any knowledge of science or, you know, mathematics or biology. It's a need to protect yourself from the unknown. It comes before science. That doesn't make it more relevant, of course, but it makes it more logical. I mean, people need to protect themselves by assuming there is something great out there, creating us, helping us, protecting us, and then, you know, the mathematics, the geometry, it all came later.
Just to add to the point, so religion comes, well, what if you deconstruct religion, especially primitive religion, from which modern religions have evolved? It's really based on a combination of fear, causation, fear of death. You know, when the primitive man used to face the scary unknown, like a storm or a hurricane or a tornado or lightning, or, you know, they used to try to interpret it with causation, which we have evolved with, because our ancestor who feared the causation of the shaking of the bush survived being eaten by the lion, for example, and you know, so that causation has evolved in us, and we always seek the causes behind things. It makes us more comfortable. It removes fear for us. So this is where the basis of the primitive religion, and it just evolves. So this is what I mean. I think that's what they mean by natural, that it's something that we've evolved to believe in who moved the bush, you know, to remove our fear and to protect ourselves and to survive. So it comes natural to us. But, you know, then you have organized religion, which is, you know, an offshoot of that. But eventually, how can we, that's a struggle. That's why I think Richard Dawkins himself had focused on, at a certain time of his life, on public, sorry? on public public perception of science, because there's a discrepancy. How do we, that's an effort of scientists, how do we make the public understand science? Because there's a big discrepancy. I think Zerar can also comment on this.
Yes, I've been waiting. Thank you. I've been so patient. I really like your talk, and I like the thing that the book that you mentioned, and then you explained it in good detail. My immediate thought actually was, and looking at that slide, was actually thinking when I grew up, I actually felt that most people's religion seemed unnatural to me. And there were some that seemed natural. If I encountered certain people, certain thinkers, I felt it was natural. When I encountered the Mu'tazila, who were like the group at the time, back in the early days of Islam, who were all about taking the Quran with reason and stuff, it seemed very intuitive to me. But then with that, though, there's certain religions, it's very interesting, that maybe in the West, religion, by definition, like separates you from the world. Like it's you, and then the divine is a separate thing. As you go east, it's interesting, like in Hinduism, there's not supposed to be a separation. And the east, far east, they actually view, science is also like naturalism, it's called, like the study of the natural world. And so that's a real big thing in the East. And so, it just made me wonder whether different people would approach science differently. Maybe there's something that we grow up with in the West that makes it seem like science is so unnatural. But by definition, science is based, that's what's funny, science by definition is based on the natural world, which should make it natural. And then in some traditions, that's how you view religion is based on the natural world. And so, I don't know if you've encountered that, like different. It's not only religion is unnatural, but we might find certain people's religion is unnatural to you. That sounds really harsh, but I don't know if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think we're using the word natural also in multiple dimensions.
Yeah, maybe like unintuitive. Like so. Yeah.
Doesn't that mean that it isn't evolutionary religion?
Well, if you grew up here, another.
Oh yes, I was trying to think as you talk.
But somebody else's religion from the East is different, and you don't find it natural. And doesn't that sort of muck with the whole evolution part of it?
I just like to give these questions to specialists, so you don't, So my topic was more of Islamic reform. I don't want to comment a lot about evolutionary biology because it's not my specialty.
Just to clarify that thing, I think what Sam just meant is that for most people, their religion is more natural to them than science is. So when they encounter science, it seems very unnatural. That's what I took.
Yeah, well, I liked all of the presentations. Very different. I have a few comments. Two things. One, you gave us some historical sources. You mentioned a book that you're preparing, Min al-Qur'an, was it? And is that available? When would it be available?
It's already published and available, but it's not available on like Amazon.
But through you, through Muslimish?
Yeah, no, it's through a different organization.
Okay, but you can help us find it?
Sure.
And related to that, maybe Muslimish or you could offer some simple resources. I've spoken to a number of imams. They're almost all immigrants, but even African American. They're very knowledgeable. I can't talk to them. Two women in particular. I know many people will know her, Fatima Mernissi, and then here in the States, I think it's Amina McLeod. I think are doing some very good analytical work, but also pointing out things that I can relate to as trying to understand and not reject everything about my faith. Now on the question, it's interesting, I find that those two people I mentioned are women. I just have a thing about a lot of male teachers, and especially our Arab people, and you pointed out the rhetoric that they use, which is also in the Quran, and they're trained, I guess, to talk like that. And that is, I just shut down, and I think a lot of other people do, if I'm trying to listen to them. And I don't know what we do about that, except get a whole new bunch of imams and maybe some women in the system. Then the question, finally, of the effort you said is required by you to relate evolution and Islam, in your case. And I'm just finding, within Islam, I have to work very, very hard. I did not grow up with Quran. I only grew up with a few prayers and references, but no real practice. So I depend on English translations, number one. And apart from my age, it takes a lot of effort to try to break through. You know, I am not willing to reject Allah, frankly. I'm not willing. Khalil talked about, you talked about the music of Islam and the art, and then you decided it's a, like, a painkiller. And it may be, did you say that? But let me just finish briefly, that it's not a pain, I don't feel it's a painkiller for me. Somehow it connects me with life outside me. So I'll just
to clarify that, I'm an artist, so I use art and music and all that stuff. I was talking about Sufism, not music and art.
I understand.
It wasn't a question.
Yeah. Thank you for the comment. Yeah.
It's not really a comment, it's more, I mean, it's not a question, it's more of a continuation of the comment by Ibrahim regarding the religion and the science being one more natural and the other one is less natural. So we are humans and we are evolved with stories, and stories give us the model of the universe. And when we refer to science, some people actually confuse the word science with different definitions. Science, when we talk about science, is referred to the scientific method of discovery and depiction of the natural world. But for most people, when they hear science, they just mean that some new scientific research that just they see on the internet, and sometimes new research study overrides the old one. So they say, oh, you know, the science is, it's just, we can't trust science. So that's one thing. Second thing is, when you look at the human society, the scientists are a tiny fraction of the whole society. So, for example, if you look at the American society, one of the Western most advanced societies, if you take a general consensus of this, the American society, more than 80% of Americans belong to a certain religion. And if you go to the scientific community, that this percentage goes down significantly to 40%. And if you take it to the elite scientists, when we say elite scientist, somebody who's a PhD in science and having more than 2 research papers published in a reputed peer-reviewed journal more than twice a year. The elite body of the American Scientific Council, more than 93% of them identify themselves as atheist or agnostic. But still, there are 7% of the elite scientists of America, they belong to a certain religion. So in words of Dr. Tyson, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, he says, before we talk to a common person, why do you believe in religion? We should not. We have no right to talk to a common person before we go to those elite scientists and ask their reasoning, try to understand why such a sophisticated mind is still believing those primitive stories. We cannot argue with a common person. We cannot just understand the reason they need such stories. So my point is, this is quite complicated. It's not as scientific as we think it is. Human mind definitely needs its reasons to believe in those stories and a simplified model of the universe. Thank you.
I should just point out, in science, there's interesting, there's certain fields that end up being more religious. There's some fields that no one really ends up being religious. So I think it's physics, especially theoretical, and mathematics often, it's like more likely.
Thanks, Sidhar.
Yes, I have a question about the reformation of Islam. Certainly, an argument could be made that the process by which Christianity has increasingly secularized itself over the centuries and introduced questioning of certain Christian scriptures. And this process that you mentioned whereby Christians say, you know, with those things, we can kind of leave that scripture alone, but this scripture is more important. There could be an argument made, and I'm sure many people make it, that to do that with Islam, as progressive as it would be, as much as that would bring about what many would argue would be a much needed reformation within the faith, that could potentially leave the faith open to certain pitfalls that Christianity has already succumbed to, namely the decline of religious adherence to the faith, decline of the influence of the faith in the world. And I tend to think that the tendency, which is my understanding, which is extremely limited by my own admission, that there's this idea within Islam that it is at the very least preferable if as many people in the world as possible were to convert to Islam compared to other faiths. So, you know, in Christianity, there is this evangelical tradition of preaching the gospel, but it's kind of like, you know, take it or leave it. It's almost as if there's a progression from Judaism, which is very insular, you know, it's Jews and Gentiles, to Christianity, which everyone is welcome, to Islam, which seems to be the case that, you know, we would really, really, really prefer it if everyone were Muslim, maybe 1,000, 10,000 years from now. And opening Islam up to the same sort of reformative mechanisms that Christianity has accommodated would potentially compromise that possibility. Specifically, I tend to think that the nature of Islam and the way that Islamic societies are organized give Muslims bigger and fuller families than everyone else in the world, demographically speaking. So what would you say to someone who would make that argument that a reformation within Islam would lead to a decline of Islamic fullness, and that should actually be avoided to avoid some of the things that Christianity is running into?
Well, there's definitely pitfalls in reformation of Islam, but the non-reformation of Islam has the greater risk for Islam itself, and is struggling with that. Right now, there is a clash of new sectarianism. There are new formulation of groups, and there is also a movement of leaving Islam, of secularism, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's sometimes it's not based really on a different understanding. It's just based on being repelled away from religion, which might lead to a formulation of different kind of cults or religions or new forms of spiritual circles, which, you know, it creates a more danger and risk on the Islamic society than intellectual-led reform movement. And also, the resistance to reformation is just leading to more extremism, because the extremism is holding on more fundamentally to the core practice of religion in resistance to the pressure of reform. There's a third risk, which was one of the reasons that Muslimish is established, is that there is this choice between either being within Islam or completely stripping oneself from Islam and all its related cultures. You'll find an individual who would leave completely, change name, and just rip themselves completely away from the culture as a runaway. They just run away from Islam and everything. And that has a lot of suffering attached to it. And we have to support the voice of reformation within Islam, because it's the only natural thing. Otherwise, that buildup of pressure will either result in violence or a deformation, really, of religion, which we're seeing, for example, in Iraq. The amount of new sects and after the fall of Saddam, and this the open, free environment for interpretation and movement within dynamic movement within Islam has shown us what can this happen. There used to be like one or two or three Islamic thoughts or ideologies. Now there's hundreds within the cities of Iraq. So summary of the answer of your question is that there is some compromises that the Muslim society has to pay for the sake of reformation. The compromises will be much higher if they resist it.
Do you have any comments?
No, I think I'll just emphasize the point that you just said. We're seeing a clash right now. It's either if you're a fundamentalist and you're looking at what where the world is going, there is a clash between your beliefs, practices, and the natural course of humanity. So it's either you reform or you will be in constant violence and war with the rest of the world. So it has to happen.
All right, this is a question directed towards Wissam, but Khalil and Ali, you're also more than free to jump in. Before Wissam, you're finishing your presentation, and I think towards the last slide, you're trying to talk about Islamic nationalism. Can you please clarify a bit more on that?
So in summary, because this was like the second section of the talk, and I knew that I'm not going to have time to get there, but I put it as just a ihtiyatan, yeah, it's a precaution. In summary, so sometimes Islam is taken a form of national. I'll give you an example. When the Muslims protest the cartoons of the Prophet, as far as religion is concerned, the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, is as blasphemous in Islam as cartoons against Prophet Isa, as writings against God. So why pick and choose and only react to such an incident rather than so? Because sometimes it is not really about what religion is, what the religion says. It is a nationalistic reaction that this is we are being attacked as people. Rather than and what we hold dire. So the mix between Islam and nationalism can complicate the dialogue with Islam. I like what Ibrahim said in his presentation when he said that if Muslims are going to be put in concentration camp, then I'm a Muslim. Because then it is really about, and he said, because they are my people. So there is, I know it is very clear the effect of the nationalization of Judaism, right? I mean, that's a whole theme within the movement of the Jewish history. But in Islam, it is not really clear-cut, but sometimes you see it in such reactions where it is really about them attacking us. One of the things we wanted to do as Muslimish, because we are a voice from within Islam, we're probably accepted more within our societies than if a speaker who is foreign to Muslims is speaking to them directly. They will probably think this is a plan, coming back to conspiracy theory. It's a Zionist plan to take over, or it's an attack on Islam. But if a Muslim is from within their community speaking to them about the need of, questioning Islam or reforming Islam or whatever it is, they will accept it more because there is less national identity clash in that sense. So there's more to that, but that's in summary what I was going to say.
Yeah, just going back to that gentleman's question regarding the changing Islam, couldn't you look at it in this perspective? That basically all ideologies change over time. They must, just because of the exigencies of life. The Jews of 2019 are not the Jews of biblical times. Two groups probably wouldn't have anything to do with each other. And that's what I'm thinking. So it seems to me the fundamentalist elements of any group are going to want to cling to what they believe is the golden past. Somebody told me many years ago that every society remembers a golden age that never was. And so you find Hasidic Jews, and they look at it this way. You find the Sunnis look at it another way of what they consider the real Islam, the real Judaism, the real past, the real Christianity. But 100 years after Christianity started, it was not, most definitely not the religion of Jesus Christ. It became something else. So I'm just wondering if that's more, looking at it in that perspective, would be more positive and helpful.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Thank you. I mean, I would take this as a comment, definitely. Yeah, this is a natural progression. People are in denial sometimes.
It's growing pains. We all do it.
Right.
For lots of reasons.
And this is about really creating an environment where people accept that safely, without, you know, removing the fears and threats of that.
So thank you guys for your talks. So they were very. I always like Muslimish conferences because whenever I can see something from a different perspective, it always makes me very happy. The question that I have is for both Khalid and Ali regarding conspiracy theories. So I think what I was thinking about was you mentioned something, Khalid, about in your hometown there was just numerous numbers of young people who were recruited into ISIS, and I'm wondering. I can imagine that there's some conspiracy theories that played a role, so I'm wondering if there was anything that you heard or anything that, like the recruiting strategy, essentially, is what I'm wondering about. And then the other question is for Ali, which is, when it comes to conspiracy theories, especially nowadays, if you have any idea about anything and you just type it into Google, you will find some document that confirms that idea. So I'm wondering, you know, this is even for us scientists, when we know that you know there are credible sources that you can trust or whatever, we still have to scrutinize those sources. So I'm wondering, how do you approach that, or what would you recommend?
Conspiracy, yeah, it's actually a fact in our community. I mean, we have it in our mind. It's natural. Those numerous people that they get recruited in the mosques to go to ISIS. I've been there, like, in some durus, which is like lessons that they give after salat, after the prayers. When I was a kid, but I didn't totally understand it. By telling you that jihad is a part of our religion, and to be more specific in Tunis, they tell them, like, for example, Americans and Yahud or Zionists are attacking Islam, and Islam is in danger. I remember in the first election after the revolution, there is this film, like short film, was diffused on one of the national TVs. It was translated. And one of the characters in this cartoon was presenting God. And I remember, like, every Tunisian was in the street calling to stop this channel. And because of that, they started this conspiracy concept or notion in their mind. And they were like, Islam in danger, so we have to vote to the Islamic part. And that's why they get the power. But also there is something else, which is the emotions. The emotions and helping those kids. In the mosques or in the universities or in schools, whenever they find a student or someone like needs help or needs money, they go for it. They first help him. And then I remember like a small story, short story. It was like a guy who doesn't have any money and he just get out of jail. And they started like giving him money. I know him personally. So it was like, he got this, salary, and he wasn't doing any job. He was just going with them and talking to them and learning from them. After like 3 months, he became with a bar and, like, you know, the hurka, like the dress and all that stuff. And and they stopped paying him. So I remember the fight that he that he had with this group. Like, why do you guys stop paying me? And yeah, it's just that's all I have. Yes, I could be talking.
Thank you for your question. It's actually the only way to counter the conspiracy theory model is simply to verify. You talked about scientific approach. Basically, go for the facts, because in conspiracy theory, that even if they provide some facts or that would look like facts in any argument, if you go beyond step one and two and try to verify, you will end up with nothing. For instance, if you talk about the 9/11, we're just talking about how the towers fell, and a lot of people would say, I mean, you cannot have the towers fall because of the burning of the fuel. The fuel burns, let's say, around 900 Celsius. And for the steel structure, you need something more or above than 1100 Celsius. Well, if you go to the engineering part of that, it's simply you're becoming more elastic. The steel structure is not designed to carry that weight in an elastic mode under a 900 Celsius fire. So basically what's happening is it's bending slowly, and then it's falling from above to below, to the bottom. And the other thing is, the other argument, for instance, I'm just giving examples on how to verify. They say it's a controlled bombing. You look at how it fell. I mean, basically, go and watch two videos of a controlled demolition of a building, and look at how the towers fell. The tower fell from top to bottom, and controlled demolition. It's the lower floors actually they blow up, and then the rest will fall on top. What happened? It's exactly the opposite. I read one of the stories that talked about the theory of there was actually no plane in the Pentagon. No one attacked the Pentagon. So. And they were quoting a CNN reporter, and the name was there, and the quote was there. Okay, anyone who would just stop at this level, they would say, oh my God, I mean, we have someone who talked, and then it just got, you know, buried somewhere. But if you go and verify, the guy never said that. If you go and try to find a verified, reliable source, he never said that. He never said that, I never saw a plane or the grass is intact, it was not burned. So go beyond level one or level two. When I was at the Times in Baghdad, we usually, I mean, for instance, we get something from the Ministry of Interior, and we'll be asked to verify it from another source. So we'll have at least two independent sources to verify that. So it's not just sources, science plays a big role in this, because what we just talked about, people who just think, okay, you know, science says that you cannot burn the towers. Well, it could happen scientifically. It is possible. And I talked to the author of one of the books written about the 9/11, and he visited the site several times. He has a PhD in physics, and he said there was no traces of dynamite whatsoever. There was no traces of bombing whatsoever. Plus the logic of, you know, having hundreds of employees, that if you have that order coming from top to bottom, how many people do you need to carry that out and, you know, keep the secret? I think it's gonna be almost impossible to keep the secret like that. Thank you.
I just want to add one point to this, that we have also an issue, since you're talking about science verification, the commercialization of research. So you'll have research done by a group in college or something, and then you'll have an article written to state the results of the research. But this article, the title of the article, the way it's written, it changes the results of the article just by using different kind of words, in order for them to get more readability to it. And I think that hurts us a lot, hurts science a lot, the way, you know, they try to dramatize the results of the research. Sometimes it's just a simple correlation, between, let's say, boldness and libido. And then the article comes out to be, oh, bold men have more libido. You know, it's nothing to do with the results, the scientific results, but they use it to just create that commercialization of, now I have a habit when I see an article like this, I actually click on the research to read what the actual research was, and I have a different understanding of it. Thank you.
Okay, so we'll, I guess, draw to a close. I was going to add one comment to what Elvie's conspiracy thing is. I don't know if anyone's seen that. South Park has an episode about the 9/11 conspiracies, and I'll just give the episode away, but it's pretty funny. So they try to find out where the conspiracy comes from, and it comes from Dick Cheney and the government. And it's because the government wants you to think that they are powerful enough to do something like this. And so I feel like it goes back to the dictator comment too. But yeah, and so yeah, so we'll have a closing statement. I think Ibrahim or Sam will give it. And like I mentioned, right afterwards, if you could just quickly leave, and then if you're going to converse, you can converse on the bridge or where we ate the tables there, as we have to leave this area by 5:30.
Just want to say thank you so much for coming to the conference today. I feel that, well, I want to thank everyone personally, because I think your participation is very important to us. We are a small group still, even after years of having regular meetings in New York and five other cities. And I think having people come to our conference is very encouraging to us. I feel Muslimish is one of the few places within the Muslim community where we can have this conversation among themselves. I'm very happy with the participation today, that everyone said their opinion, and I think we had a good discussion. I'm really happy with that. A lot of great ideas. And that's what we want to continue to do. So, again, I want to remind everyone with the goals of the group, because, you know, I'm goal-driven, and I want everybody to know what the goals are, because I don't want someone to come 6 years later and tell me, well, what are the goals? The goals are three goals: to create a place for discussion, to foster a plural society, and to abolish blasphemy laws. We want to give the freedoms that we have here to everyone in the Muslim world to be able to discuss their most, the most important raison d'etre, the reason of existence. It's the most core question that everyone asks themselves: why are we here? To be able to discuss that and talk about it. Again, there's still some food out here in the quarter, so we don't want it to get spoiled. So please grab a sandwich, and we have happy hour. We're going to Treadwell Park, so please join us for a drink, or not, or yeah. But or a non-haram drink, you always can get a seltzer cranberry. So please join us. Thank you so much again for coming, and I hope to see you next conference. Take
care. Thank you for listening to Muslimish Free Thinkers. Do let us know what you think of this episode at facebook.com/Muslimish. Don't forget to visit us at muslimish.org.